I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings. At the Modern, Tuesday Evenings is a weekly lecture series. It's free and open to the public with, I must say, an exceptional lineup that runs through November 19th this fall. You can find the listing with descriptions on the Modern's website. And, of course, it's exceptional because of the people that agreed to be here, not because of any doing of my own. Tonight we have something a little different. Gabriel Curry, whose Three Arrested Clouds and Complimentary Cornice and Intervals are both featured in Mexico Inside Out, Themes and Art Since 1990, is in conversation this evening with Tyler Green of Modern Art Notes fame for a live audience taping for an episode of Modern Art Notes podcast. So while, as you are generally, a very participatory audience, attentive and with good questions, tonight that might be even more pronounced. So I'm glad you could be here for this. Since Tyler has an introduction of his own, I will limit mine to a reiteration of the announcement of tonight's lecture by noting that Gabriel Curry is a citizen of the globe and that while born in Mexico, he lives and works in Mexico City, Brussels, and Los Angeles, where he has recently moved. He has shown internationally for more than 15 years with inclusion in many, if not most, of the major international exhibitions such as Illuminations of the 54th Venice Biennale and the 5th Berlin Biennial. Gabriel's poetic touch with materials accumulated from the flux of life that speak to our values as consumers no doubt contributed to the selection of his work for critically acclaimed exhibitions that celebrate his aesthetic, including Brave New Worlds at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis and Unmonumental at the New Museum in New York. And as I understand, he has something coming up in Paris very soon, at the end of November. He also, to make my point, his work has recently been featured in solo exhibitions in Norway, Beirut, Mexico City, London, Berlin, Boston, and Houston. I'm sure that many of you have come across it at one or more of these locations. Tyler Green, of course, comes with his own credentials as a Washington-based art journalist who edits and writes Modern Art Notes. He is the U.S. columnist for Modern Painter and has been the subject of stories in famed publications and programs with the Wall Street Journal calling MAN, so Modern Art Notes, the most influential of all visual arts blogs, and stating that you won't find a better informed art writer than Tyler Green. The Washington Post named him one of Washington's 14 young influential cultural figures. And the Modern Art Notes podcast, which is the format of tonight's presentation, is the most listened to audio program on art in the United States. It is distributed each Thursday through various means, including the site manpodcast.com, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Tyler's fascination with, knowledge of, and commitment to art is evident, and we are fortunate to have him here tonight as he visits with Gabriel Curry in an exploration of the ideas manifested in Gabriel's often humorous and inevitably profound works. So before turning it over, please join me in welcoming Tyler Green and Gabriel Curry.
This is all kinds of fun for me. I've been coming to this museum for I don't know how many years. This is probably about my 15th time here. There is pretty much no better set of galleries anywhere in the country to look at art. The spaces here are great. A year or two ago, I flew down here just to see the Diebenkorn Ocean Park show here because I knew it would be better here than anywhere else. So this is a lot of fun. So as Terry said, tonight we're taping an episode of the Modern Art Notes podcast. This will go out next Thursday over iTunes and SoundCloud and RSS feed and all the other places. So if you don't know the show, every week we feature an interview, most weeks two interviews with curators, artists, historians, authors, and next week it will be Gabriel. And so what we'll do is we'll tape for about an hour, and then we'll open it up to questions. And that should work pretty well, right? So we do one bit of artifice at the very beginning, to kind of like begin taping. And then we'll just talk. So here we go. Gabriel Curry, welcome to The Modern, and welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get started, you told me when we were walking in that you have just moved your studio, that you're moving to Los Angeles. You've worked for years in Brussels and in Mexico City. Why moving to Los Angeles and why now?
Very simple reason is I wanted a change of air for me and my family, and me and my work and my family. And after 10 years in Brussels, we couldn't think of a more violent change than going to Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is a city that has always attracted me. It's very strange and chaotic, and we're trying it out. Mm. It's close enough to Mexico, but not Mexico, so I sometimes like the things that I love the most at a distance, so we'll see how it goes.
You've installed and made work for venues all over the world. For some artists, Richard Diebenkorn comes to mind. It mattered a great deal where his studio was. Mm-hmm. Will it matter for you that you're in LA as opposed to Brussels?
I think it will, definitely, although I don't know what will happen to my work. And this question has been asked many times about my choice for Brussels, which is, of course, a very unlikely and strange place to be. And somehow it's also a place that doesn't really impose certain behavior or certain norms with such force. So I always thought to myself, I can live here with enough lightness on my feet that I will really call the shots, and I'll decide how much I engage and how much really all this seeps into me and into my work. And then, you know, a few years down the line, I thought it would be so clear and undeniable to look back in 10 years' time and see, you know, the period I lived in Brussels is going to be really in the work. So although I couldn't exactly tell how it would change, I know it's there somehow. And I suppose now, you know, moving to Los Angeles or to wherever else, that will surely have an effect on the work.
Well, let's jump into your career and let's start at the very beginning. I didn't know this until I read an interview you did with Katerina Gregos, but you started out as a painter, and your paintings frequently included words. So what were those paintings like? And it's interesting that they included words because your titles are very important to the objects you make now. So what words were you using back then in the late 80s?
Well, I was interested. To say that I started out as a painter, it's an interesting, it almost feels like an interesting provocation. Because I was never really interested in painting per se. Of course, there's something really liberating about the possibilities of painting. You can really, you know, to put it in very simplistic terms, you can really paint whatever you want if you compare it to a technique like photography. You know, they have different limitations, and you know, suddenly having a canvas allowed me to do anything I wanted. But what I wanted was really in the realm of semantics. What I was interested in was not so much in paint, but in how meaning was constructed. So yes, my paintings at the time were composed by images and words, and these words were, you know, sound bites from my life, I guess, in not too different way to now the little objects that I pick up and I incorporate into the work. And Yeah, I mean, what did they look like? This would have been around the late 80s. So I guess they had the mark of the late 80s. I was going to school then. And
lots of neon colors or lots of mismatched bright colors? Or
Colors. Probably not so bright, but maybe if I painted any better, they would have been a bit brighter. Yeah.
And were you using individual words? Were you using phrases? How were you?
I was using individual words and phrases. You know, I was looking a lot at Ed Ruscha, for instance. He was remains a hero of mine, and something I admired and still admire of him is how the precision in the work. You know, yeah. Although the choice of phrases and words can be somehow claimed to come from popular culture, like everyone's culture, it's the precision of the choice that is remarkable. And somehow I would aspire my work to have a similar or an equivalent precision in its choice. I look at what's around me and I, you know, point my finger at certain things, and I would like my models to somehow be one of precision, of selection. My work is open. It incorporates a lot of different aspects and materials and situations, but that doesn't mean it's some sort of everythingism that anything goes, you know. I really aspire to have a rigor, to have a system, to have a incision in my choice. And that, you know, back then had to do with me looking at an artist like him, or me trying to work with words that had a certain, you know, a uniqueness or a certain ring to them.
So at the time you were making these early paintings in the late 80s, you were working in the studio of Gabriel Orozco. About how old were you?
That started in 87,
right.
So I was between 16 and 17. I was going to high school.
So the first thing I was wondering about that is, how did you end up working in his studio at such an early age?
It was a family connection.
Oh.
Yeah, basically, to cut the story short, Gabriel spent long periods at my cousin's house.
Oh.
Because, you know, he was quite a free teenager. And, you know, when I was 9, I suddenly turned up at my cousin's house, and there he was. And so were a bunch of, you know, their friends who had, like, long hair and read, you know, interesting books. And he became some sort of figure that I always looked up to. And then one day I decided to become an artist, and this situation of working in his workshop one day a week with other fellow artists, Damian Ortega, Abraham Cruz Villegas, and Dr. Lacra, started, it developed into a very interesting dynamic. So it was a once weekly activity, dynamics. And I think that was really the backbone of my formation. It was more or less, as I said, I was still in high school when it started, but it went through my undergrad years, and really that is where I learned the most valuable things, more than I did in school. In art school, I learned more, you know, techniques, but I didn't really engage in the same way that we engaged in the workshop every Friday at Gabriel's.
So what were the most important things you learned in the studio?
Well, it was, I guess, a combination of working alongside my fellow artists and always being very open in discussion about, you know, the problems that we encountered, and also observing Gabriel's work. Although he has always said that he doesn't like the figure of a teacher, he knows very well that he is that kind of person that really... you know, it's very enriching to be working next to him. It's not like we had the dynamics of a little school or a study group. It was basically, you know, we just turned up and each one of us worked in our own thing. And, you know, this was a time in which there were certain problems in the air, and we brought them with us every Friday, and we discussed them and we worked. And as I said, this is a place that I learned more than I learned at school. Because we had certain freedom. We were not there to, you know, follow certain exercises or learn certain techniques. So it was really much more about building our discourse and, you know, trying to figure out why, you know, we were doing what we were doing, what, you know, whether it made sense and why we wanted to make what we were making, why make art, you know.
Were you the only guy painting?
I was not the only guy.
Oh, really?
We were all painting.
Oh, you all were?
Abraham was painting and,
oh, wow.
Well, somehow.
This isn't a group of artists who are typically considered colored mud on canvas types.
No, but the funny thing is that it feels to me that we all probably started making images, although maybe not so very interested in paint per se. At the time, you know, Mexico, I guess, since the modernist period, has been very much an image-based culture, if you like. And at the time, you know, in the mid-80s, there was a lot of image production. And then, you know, each one of us, I guess, naturally veered more to the practice of sculpture. But myself, I still consider that I very often make images when I work with objects, you know, like the pieces are somehow images of themselves, and although they are freestanding objects and they have the properties of a thing, yeah, very often I look at them in their semantic potential the same way I would look at an image. So I wasn't really trained with the traditional values and principles of sculpture. Maybe that's probably why I make the kind of sculpture I make, because it came from the image.
So to American critics, especially, I guess, maybe American critics of my age,
You're not that old, are you?
No, but I imagine it's different for critics 20 years on either side of me, or 15 years. You know, I guess to us, Orozco is kind of the godfather of Mexican contemporary art of the last 20 or 30 years. And I wonder if you think of him the same way, or if that's an American looking at Mexico.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I can tell you that because I completely lived through it. This was not something that I learned from American or any other critics. Gabriel was or is someone who is just exceptionally talented and intelligent, and he also found himself in a moment in which there was, you know, there was also the opportunity. You know, it coincided with the threshold of globalization and a number of contextual conditions that made it possible somehow for a voice like him to really burst out. And I think he also had the nerve to really look at the situation look at the potential of the situation in an amazing way. And that's why, you know, his voice had suddenly such an impact. And he really generated such a wave of art following him.
So one of the dominant themes or subjects that runs through your work is consumerism, stuff, people buying stuff, the inevitability of people buying stuff. Is that an interest that you began to develop while working for him, or did you get to that idea later as you went to school, when you went to London for grad school? When did you become interested in consumerism and stuff?
Well, first of all, I should say, I don't think you meant it that way, but I didn't really work for him. We worked in the workshop, each one of us in our own thing. Sure enough, he was, you know, some sort of leading figure there. And my interests in the world of commerce have really always been there. Back then, when I was making paintings, I was looking at a lot of packaging, for instance, and a lot of like publicity slogans, and I just see that the very vigorous exchange in terms of communication that happens in the world of commerce is just it's just flowing towards me all the time, and you know, with my practice, I make a commentary on this. Sometimes it's more evident than others. Sometimes it's more explicit than others. But in a sense, that is a way of engaging with the world, a way of communicating. And it just seems to me that there's always some sort of economic transaction in any trope of communication. Even the fact that we are sitting here, there are a number of economic conditions and transactions that had to happen for this to be possible. And, you know, as I said, sometimes this is more evident and it's more on the surface and it's easier to comment in a more explicit way, but I think somehow it's always there. It has to do with communication.
So you're making stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an irony there that you're critiquing and you're in the arena of commenting on consumerism, but that you're also making objects that are then consumable? Or is that something that is just inevitable and so it goes?
Well, very often I ask myself, you know, quietly and also with the work, what side am I on? Am I a producer? Am I a consumer? Often I'm a producer by consuming. I mean, this is a kind of a circular.
Well, let me
circular question.
Let me interrupt you, because I think one of the pieces in the show here is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Complementary cornice and intervals.
Mm-hmm.
I guess could you quickly describe the piece? To grant it for people, we'll have images on Modern Art Notes and on manpodcast.com, and explain maybe how it does that.
Well, this is a series of marble slabs that are just propped against the wall, and there is a row of complementary cosmetics that's sitting on the ledge, on the top of the
hotel shampoo and so
hotel
on.
Shampoos and all that sort of stuff that you supposedly get for free, you know, but you know, we pay for them. And I collected these while I was traveling. I still do. And I'm interested in this economy of gratuity or generosity, or how, you know, prices can sometimes be very explicitly quoted, and sometimes they are hidden, and sometimes they're hidden with a smile, and sometimes they are aggressively hidden, etc. And all these kind of economies which are below the surface. I think just like there are many ways in which we communicate which are extraverbal or are between the lines, all of these things I'm interested in commenting on. And then there's also the very physical, the very material aspect of the work, which can be, you know, can have such an anecdotal reference as just turning up at a friend's house and seeing how my friend had collected also these shampoos and put them on the top of the shower, the structure,
the
sliding
shelf
door
or something. Yeah.
You know, to me that is that's a sculpture of every day. You know, how I negotiate with material. I mean, if you look around, there is, you know, there are all these little gestures that I think are very telling of how, you know, you put this on this surface like this, and you know, the audience may have also chosen to stuff their bag in the seat in a certain way, or have their little pen or their ticket stuffed in a certain way. That for me is really that's where my investigation lies. You know, how we can relate to space, to objects, to all these situations. That's really where sculpture becomes for me.
So in that piece, how important is it that you are using these consumerist items that already exist in the world, that you are not fabricating something new, not making something new, but that you are repurposing something that is already out there, that you are not being additive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's like making something out of nothing. Of course, that nothing is ironic, because this is something that was produced and was paid for, but that is granted as not having a lot of value because it's a giveaway. So repurposing, I think, is an interesting way to put it. And somehow, you know, I like to give back the stuff that was given to me as an artwork. I can give another example. There was a period in which I was settling in Europe, and it was like transitional period in my fiscal history, where I was paying my taxes still in Mexico, but under a scheme that allowed me to pay in nature, so with artwork instead of with money. And then I was getting my papers sorted in Belgium, so I didn't have to pay my taxes there, but I was collecting a lot of receipts and invoices, and then I didn't really have to report these in either fiscal system. And then I found I had this huge stack of them. And, you know, after, a lot of thinking and all the other incidents that my work somehow led, I ended up making an artwork out of them. And I felt this is a way for me to give them back to society. I know it sounds a little romantic, but I couldn't do anything with them like most other people had to, you know, to file them and for them to become part of the administration. So I gave them back as an artwork. So things that would otherwise be thrown away, if they find a way back into the work, that gives me special satisfaction.
And those are the tapestries, the receipts that became tapestries?
In the case of the receipts that became tapestries, they were the source for a work. But I'm talking about pieces in which I used the actual tickets.
Like the collages.
The actual receipts, like collages, or the column. This is a piece that I showed in the quick slideshow, where I literally scoured through like a year and a half's worth of tickets, receipts, invoices, everything.
I want to come back to those pieces in a minute, but one more thing on complementary cornice and intervals. Until today, I had only seen that piece in photographs. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was much taller and bigger than it was. And when I was in front of it, I was conscious of it being a much more human-scaled piece, a much more body-scaled piece. And I wonder if you like the idea that when people encounter it away from the white cube, that it has a different there's a different reference point, that there's a scalelessness to it, that it could, that there's a malleability to it.
Well, a lot of the work that I do in the studio, it sounds a little obvious, but it's work that I can handle myself. In the in this aspect of the work, which is a solitary practice in the studio, obviously I need to be able to handle the. So they have my body imprinted somehow. Yeah, I couldn't have done a piece with huge marble slabs because physically I was not able to. Very often, you know, art history has it that if you read carefully enough, you realize, you know, certain very celebrated artists had a door frame that was of a certain size, and that determined, you know. Yeah. Like 20 years worth of historic painting.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's the way it happens.
Well, you mentioned receipts, so let's switch to that body of work. You made a piece involving not just receipts. I don't know what the word for them is. They're these little tickets you get when you're in line somewhere. You know, it says like number 36 on it, and you're at the deli, and you wait for the guy behind the deli counter to call 34, 35. 30. Do you have any idea what they're called? Are they called anything?
You can call them waiting tickets.
Waiting tickets. I like it.
Turn tickets.
So you use those in collages for a number of years. Maybe you still do.
Yep.
And they are, these pieces are just remarkably clever, sometimes funny. Probably my favorite, if I'm allowed to have a favorite, is an untitled collage, in parentheses, titled Circle of Planes. Mm-hmm. I guess before we get to that specific collage, why those little tickets?
Well, they are very significant little documents of that hideous time that you have to spend waiting. You know? And you're looking at the ceiling, wondering when your turn will come. Sometimes it's longer than you expected and you would have wished for. And, you know, I started to become drawn to these as documents, as testimonials of waiting.
As I thought about them in looking at the pieces, they do kind of tell us our place. and put us in our place.
Yeah, you have a number. They index your time. And yeah. There is something that's I mean, I'm interested in systems, and this is like, you know, in bureaucratic terms, this is exactly what they are.
So the Untitled Circle of Planes mm-hmm. features kind of a photograph of an airplane terminal with planes, you know, in the gates. Only not all of the things that we see in the collage around the terminal are planes. Every other one is one of these waiting tickets. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a great example of both a system of knowing your place in line. It almost kind of seems like a foundational piece in a way.
I think you're right. And also what could be said about this is that systems are also, they don't have to be necessarily rational sets of, prescribed rules or formulas that can be, you know, expressed in sentences or numbers. They can also be locking forms. There's a formal aspect of my work, which is, of course, quite evident, that has to do with shape, with more with material, with its physical aspect that you cannot exactly break down into, you know, systems in the more, something that you can read, but they have to do with form. So in a collage like that, it makes you aware of how these shapes, these tickets, as they come out of the machine, you know, they are cut in a certain way that they look as forms, and there are many ways in which form locks as well. And for me, that's also is also something that I study a lot with my work. And so often there are works in which you have both. Like you have maybe three. I guess the piece in the other work in the exhibition is clear in that sense. You have two.
The other piece in
rocks.
The exhibition being
the other piece in the exhibition being three arrested clouds. You have two rocks which are close enough that I decided to stuff three pairs of bald socks, which are stuffed in tension. I guess, you know, when it comes to locking forms, that's a very clear case.
Those little waiting tickets, I had never realized this until I saw your collage. They do look kind of like planes.
Yes, they are like little wings.
So are you? And the whole collage ends up being, and I hope you take this in the right way, really kind of funny.
Yeah.
It's got a very particular high, low, expensive, inexpensive kind of sense of humor on one hand, and also it's kind of mocking this kind of modernist seriality of the repeating forms of the planes on the other. So I think that sense of humor is important to the work, and at the risk of asking a really bad question, are you okay with the work being slightly funny? I mean, are you trying to kind of elicit a smile?
I'd be glad if the work makes the spectator smile. Myself, I'm also a spectator, and I think one of the very fortunate feelings that I hope for in an exhibition is to feel that the artist made a work which made me think, which enriched me, but also made me smile. If those two things happen, I think, you know, it's a good thing for sure.
Yeah, that piece still cracks me up, so I'm in favor of that. So you mentioned three arrested clouds, mm-hmm. The two rocks, the three socks, and here at the Modern, it's installed indoors, of course. But just outdoors beyond it is a Henry Moore. And I wonder if you took any pleasure in that juxtaposition of your having filled the space between the rocks with the socks and, mm-hmm. and being able to look outside and see the Henry Moore, which has, you know, which really emphasizes the space between
there is, yeah.
his forms.
I'm plotting tomorrow putting three socks on the Henry Moore sculpture. before I'm driven out to the airport. Henry Moore's work is not necessarily the kind of work that, in my view, inspires a lot of thought of those about these spaces in between. But sure enough, there is something about the rhythms and the shapes that, in a very classical sense, I appreciate in the work of Henry Moore, and suddenly there are works of mine which I think can also be appreciated, in a very classical sense. Sure enough, the space in between, how, you know, that space between forms which ultimately lock is also one of my areas of investigation. And I guess it's up to the curators of the exhibition suddenly also to make these connections, and I'm certainly glad to see that.
That was a fun moment for me, too. So I want to switch and talk about IKEA for a moment. Mm-hmm. In not only your work, but in interviews, you've noticed that IKEA is something to which much of your worldview about capitalism and the production and distribution of goods fits. And I think that's pretty great, because I think we've all had that moment when we felt that we could almost move into an IKEA store and just live there. An Israeli artist named Guy Ben-Nur has even made a video in which he presents himself and his family living in an IKEA. And I guess what makes IKEA a useful foil or a useful corporation for you to think about? Actually, first, do you own any IKEA stuff at home?
I do.
Oh, okay.
I do. And I'm not particularly proud about the fact. But I do have a rule. When I walk around IKEA with my wife, we never hold hands. Because that would be like just subscribing to this.
Buying into that.
Life of alienation and boredom. But they do certain things that no one else does, like bunk beds. I have 7-year-old twins. It's hard to get bunk beds for kids of that age anywhere else. So I have to get them there. But IKEA is a particularly fertile ground when it comes to this kind of investigation, because there are many aspects about the company that you can see. There's a lot that goes into them. I have been studying a lot, I guess you could say, behavioral economics, you know?
IKEA is a good place for that.
IKEA is a good place for that. One of the things that impresses me the most is how much effort they put into trying to predict people's needs and people's desires and how to cater for them completely before they leave the store, before they leave the experience of walking through the store. And that is pretty scary, because they go to really, really great lengths. I made one work in an exhibition in Berlin that was called, I hope I remember the title correctly, it was called An Immediate Indexation of Possibilities as a Consummation of All Desire. And it came from having walked around IKEA and seeing this palette of color that they offer in paint that is part of this global conglomerate. There are different companies around the world who supply the exact same gradient of color everywhere in the world. And it felt like every single color was contemplated. And I thought suddenly there was like me standing in front of anything I could ever desire in terms of color was there in front of me, catered for, and I suddenly had no need for color anymore. You see what I mean?
Yes.
They go through to such great length supplying and catering for people's possible desire that suddenly felt it's all done for me. I don't even have to buy this.
And you didn't.
And I didn't. But I made an artwork and I sold it. So I guess I beat the system somehow.
In that show, you made at least one piece out of objects that were from IKEA, upside down, horizontal line.
That's correct. In the beginning, I wanted to make all of this exhibition only with materials that came from
ask, yeah.
that came from IKEA. Then, you know, I just thought it was a little unnecessary and maybe too literal to do so. But there were three works that I made with materials that came from IKEA. There was another one, which I guess in the title and in its composition also had this kind of hint at futility and completeness, called a calculated journey into a calculated experience. And it was made with a makeshift table that was basically an IKEA table still packed in its flat box, still with the those belts that go around it. And that table, having never come out of its box and become a table, was propped up on two chairs and turned into a makeshift table. And then on that surface, you saw what looked like the remains of a very quick meal. You know, the sort of meal that you would have when you just moved into your new house and you were...
Or that you bought in that little cafeteria at IKEA.
Exactly. And you are maybe painting the house and you have a quick meal. And then I had these movie prop makers reproduce that perfectly with latex and resin. So you have, like, crumbs and... Excuse me, like, some soda pop in a bottle and some... chips with mayonnaise, but reproduced very, very carefully by these movie props. And of course, it's kind of messy and ugly, but it's also very clean, and it'll last a really, really long time because it's made of to last.
It's like those cafeteria probably.
It's like those replicas that you see in Japanese restaurant vitrines.
Yeah.
Except imagine that all chewed up and consumed. So then this was put on this table. So on the one hand, there was an object that never really had a chance to become what it was meant to become, and then there was a meal that happened quickly and then was freeze-framed and stayed there. So I guess in a similar way to the other work with the color gradient, there is something about desire that was kind of freeze-framed and never really fulfilled.
And I think I speak for all of us when I say we really hate you for figuring out how to use an IKEA thing without assembling it. So the piece upside down, horizontal line is waste paper bins that you put an object in, and then you've used the waste paper bins as kind of a framing device almost. So it uses the thing we normally throw trash out into as the thing that frames, a little bit of wonderful in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing every part of that was very careful. Everything from it being from IKEA, from it being something we normally throw things out into, to the receptacle being the framer of what's inside.
Sure, but what is the question?
I guess I was trying to. Could you describe what's inside the waste paper bins, and I guess how that completes the idea?
Well, these wire mesh bins have a very inexpensive and wonderful visual effect. Basically, if you walk around them, there's like this iridescence that happens, and I just realized that as I was looking at an IKEA basket, and then I put one on top of the other, and surely, as you rightly pointed out, there was a space inside that was contained and framed by the act of putting the two rings together. And what I did was I basically sealed that, and I emphasized their symmetry somehow by suggesting their connection to the ground, and then uprooting one and doing the same to the one above. So that's somehow when the title upside down horizontal line came up, because of course, you know, a line is the same upside down and downside up. And another thing that I did with that work was I tried to erase the line that we see normally connecting the floor and the wall, which is very often there when you walk into an exhibition or any particular room. So I put this very artificial device that they use in photography.
Kind of a sloping background.
Yes.
A white paper
backdrop. So that erased that line, and I suddenly wanted the line that we normally see there, that of course relates our body to the floor and reminds us of, you know, gravity. I wanted somehow that line to be raised into the work, and lightly so. So then, of course, the little object that floats inside the work is inside, you know, the baskets is somehow framed or highlighted by this. And they are very modest and fragile little things that float in there, but in a sense, because they're sealed in there and they're framed, as you said, that protects them as well. So then, you know, I invite the audience to walk around and, you know, also to have this little visual effect when they do so.
So we've gone to IKEA, we bought our stuff at IKEA, and we've gotten back a receipt that tells us what we bought at IKEA. And you've made a couple kinds of artworks about those receipts, and one of them are these hand-woven tapestries that kind of blow up the receipt that are handmade. Am I describing those reasonably?
Yes.
Well?
Yes.
And so, when the tapestries are made, it is still clearly legible in the artworks what you bought at that place. So, in for example, in one of these that's in the collection of the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego, you bought, I hope this isn't too personal, Cheetos, tuna, and light bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it important to that set of pieces what those things you're buying at the store were? Were you thinking, does it matter that they were Cheetos? Does it matter that they weren't olive oil? Or is it just a document of that day?
It is a document. The items that I bought don't really have the symbolic importance of a memento. But I hope they would have the matter of factualness and the honesty of
familiarity.
Of evidence.
Yeah.
This is what happened. The tapestries or the gold, yeah, these pieces are a facsimile, you know, not facsimile because they are an enlargement, but there's no interpretation. It's exactly what you see in the source is what you see in the larger ones. So I would like them to have that honesty and that evidence. So the actual objects that were purchased are not so important. What's more important is the testimonial. You know, I've used this word before. Let me maybe go to an example that took this a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a shop once and I carried out again a very simple purchase, and then I looked at the ticket and I thought there was something about the way that it was printed and the proportion and everything that I thought could really be woven into a good tapestry work. So I did. And then 1 year after, I thought, I was driving by the same shop, and I thought, what would happen if I went in again? It was roughly a year after. And I looked for the exact same things, potentially taking the same journey around the shop. So there was already like the hint of a replication of a moment. And I also passed them through the till in the exact same order. And then I had it woven. So I did that. There were a couple of things that were not available, and sure enough, most things had a slight increase in price. So, you know, there was already something happening that was not, you know, my decision. It was just the fluctuation in price. You could read all sorts of things that have to do with economy in that. But what was my objective was to basically do the same thing, exact same thing twice. And then I gave it to the weavers, and, you know, a completely different piece came out of it. But it had this connection in terms of the replication of the act. And then I went back a year later and I did it a third time. So then you have these three pieces that are connected in that way.
And you get the passage of time across.
You get the passage. You can read all sorts of things. And, you know, for example, that piece in the San Diego Museum, there's a, it was of a purchase made in a Mexican supermarket chain, but that was at the time bought by Walmart.
Right.
So the curators has the curators have read all sorts of, you know, corporate capitalism merging strategies into it,
yeah,
which of course are there. They were not exactly my intention. As I was saying, it's not the symbolic importance of a memento, but in a sense, it's undeniable that, you know, anything that we buy, whether big or small, has all these implications.
That reminds me that in 80 years, some German art historian will have to go figure out what Cheetos were, too, which is fun.
I wonder what I did with these. I don't eat Cheetos. I wonder why I bought them.
Yeah. The kids, probably, right?
Yeah.
So we've gone to IKEA. We bought the stuff. We've got the receipts. And we've used the stuff we bought. And so we've got to throw it out. And we've got those little plastic bags to throw them out, either to carry stuff home or to throw them out. And you've used that, too. In a couple of pieces, Clouds, and a piece called Thank You, No Thank You. Let's start with Clouds. This is a piece where you have those little plastic bags that we take stuff home from the store in. And you, I think a piece from 2004, mm-hmm. attached them to fans overhead. Am I describing that well? Is there anything you
yes.
want to add to that?
Thank You, Clouds, they're called.
Right, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So to me, that is your. There are two, I guess, references that maybe pop up in my mind when I mm-hmm. think of that piece. One is kind of the more vernacular, you know, on a windy day, here in a supermarket parking lot, you always see those bags blown around.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that interested you in that piece, or not at all?
Yes.
The second one is Warhol's Silver Clouds, which is Warhol took these Mylar balloons. Fill them up with helium. They float to the top of a white cube gallery, and you can walk amongst them. And I wonder if the relationship between your piece and Warhol's was something that motivated you or interested you.
I wasn't thinking of that piece when I made it, but you know, if you bring it up, it's of course perfectly legitimate. There was something about the weight of the bags. When they're filled with the goods, you know, and the pressure that you know creates on your hand, and suddenly the lightness of the empty bag, that was more of a motive for me to make the work. Like it had this physical origin, and you know, and once I started trying out the different compositions of the fans tied to these pivoting fans, I changed them in and positioned them in a way that they brushed against each other and then they you know freed, and there was something that was kind of chaotic about them. And then I thought, you know, maybe this can be close to Clouds, you know, rather than just shopping bags. And that's when the word that's why I said they are the Thank You Clouds. That's when the word Thank You became.
You can see, I think, the words Thank You on some of the bags.
Yes. Yes.
Because it's, you know, a multinational corporation really knows no better way to thank their customers than printing it in cheap ink on a disposable plastic bag.
Exactly.
Do you ever, you know, when I look at your work, sometimes I think I see a reference, like in that work, to Warhol, or in Complementary Cornice and Intervals, the shapes of the marble slabs. You know, they're not quite Ellsworth Kelly-esque, but they're sort of Ellsworth Kelly-esque. Do you ever, is that something you ever shoot for, or is it just kind of there, and maybe people like me who think too much?
I think it's there. It's not. I never claim any sort of genealogical belonging to this or that line, but sure enough, I've studied art history, and I love art, and I have seen a lot of art, and I draw a lot, and you know, history seeps into the work. For me, I'm interested, of course, in historical continuity. I ask myself, like, where am I in relation to what I've seen and what may be happening next? But it's not, I mean, art history is not exactly like a material that I work with. There are a lot of artists who make explicit reference to certain moments in art history. That's not really my way of working. However, I'm not going to in any way imply that I'm, you know, that all these sudden echoes come out of nowhere and I'm completely surprised. You know, often I go through periods in which I have great admiration for a certain artist and it starts showing in my work.
The last question I want to ask before we open it up. As we were walking in, we were talking about how in the last few years there have been not as many surveys of contemporary Mexican art as there were a decade ago, that this is the first big one in the U.S. in some time. And I wonder, as you walk through a show like this, if there are points of commonality or shared interest that particularly jump out at you that amongst your peers.
That's a very good question, and one that really could lead us into a very long conversation, and one that I ask myself a lot also while working away from Mexico, and inevitably when I come back and reconnect. There are certain artists in the exhibition that I have worked very closely with, like Abraham Cruz Villegas, like Damian Ortega. And in a sense, when I see their work, it almost feels like I'm talking to them, although they're not physically there. Because a lot of the things that we are constantly debating about are there.
In the work.
And there are other artists that I see their work, and sure enough, I suddenly feel where it might have come from. And then again, there's this dialogue. They speak to me, and there's this other layer as well, which is the interpretation of the exhibition organizer. And I think I quite like the exhibition because I was saying earlier that I also like to see my work in this light, like this is work that was made in Mexico or by Mexicans or, you know, by whatever can be called Mexican these days. And it's put together in such a way that it throws, you know, light that I may have not seen before, or makes me ask questions that I about my own work that I didn't before. And that's a way that's like the best thing that can happen in an exhibition like this, when it makes, you know, the artisan, and I would say inevitably also the audience, ask all these questions that haven't been asked before. And I think there is something about the use of material, there's something about the reference to politics that I wouldn't want to go as far as explaining what it is, but it just feels to have come from a country, from a city, from a circumstance like the one, you know, some of us came from or referred to. Or, you know, these days we live in very often in imaginary places as well. Like when I'm working in Brussels, I'm very often in my head, I'm working in Mexico. And that doesn't mean I'm not there, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There have people who have remained there, who have worked really, like Francis Alice, who was not even born in Mexico, but he's been in Mexico, in the center of Mexico City. And he's really worked there with all the incidents and all the, you know, in Mexico City, in the center, all these years, and really understands the place incredibly well. There are some of us who may not be physically there all the time, and that doesn't mean we're not there, you know?
Of course, you grew up there, he didn't. I mean, you and, you know, Mexico and Belgium traded you for the other. So.
No, but often you need distance also to assess the problems of where you come from. Sometimes when you're in there, you may be asking questions or just dealing with problems which are banal, and the people from outside don't find any interest. And maybe sometimes you need a little bit of distance to really, you know what I mean, to not to not get totally just trapped by the kind of unimportant, too local kind of problem. Yeah?
Let's open it up. If you have a question, I guess raise your hand.
I often see when an artist propose, which is one of those little kids, do you want your work to be understood the same way you propose it?
Did we hear that in the back?
No.
Do you want your work to be understood the same way you propose it, or are you open to a broader, different read?
I think a proposition is a fair way to say it, and that's how I would like it. I think of the work as a proposition, as an invitation, as a set of rules which I make, and you are not completely free to interpret anything you like and to make anything you like of it, because then I think there's no engagement. It's all very relative. What I would aspire is to make something that you feel free enough to make it yours and to make something of it, but it still remains, you know, the work that I proposed. I think a work in that sense is like a contract. This is what you're allowed to do. You have this freedom. I hope it's enough, and I hope you can recreate the work by interpreting it, by making it yours. But that doesn't mean you can make anything out of it. You know?
So I was looking at your case and the Slavs and the small birds and a couple of other things, trying to understand the heaviness of those Slavs and the hard life of the battles world, and trying to understand it. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was thinking, I'm understanding what is the camp's up upon propaganda.
I see. There is, of course, always the possibility that someone completely misreads it, or that interprets it in, or is offended, or, you know, the work is there. And I'm not speaking for it, it's speaking for itself. But me, as a spectator, I also like to feel that form of engagement that I said just now. When I'm standing in front of a work, I like to feel that the work says very clearly what its rules are, and then give me enough freedom to really make it mine and make something of it. But I really want to feel engaged. I don't like to stand in front of a work and just feel like it can go anywhere and everywhere, you know?
Yes.
I'm interested in this idea of three things together. Can you talk a little bit about that, especially with complementary cornets?
The question is about the idea of three things together, and if you can talk about kind of triads, trios.
Well, I mentioned this example of the tapestry, of the work that evolved, you know, 1 year and then the year after, and created a relationship of a triad. And one thing I did not mention was that after I made the second one, I thought about the third one. I suddenly thought there was an interesting connection with another tapestry work that I had made before, and it was basically the reproduction of a credit card voucher. This doesn't happen so much anymore, but they used to come in three. The top copy was for the customer. Then you had the which was normally white. Then you had the yellow copy for the
store owner.
So the store, and then you had the one for the bank. So without any of these three, the transaction becomes invalid. So there's even some kind of a Trinity aspect about it.
like Holy it's, Trinity.
It's, yeah, it can only be three, and if it's not three, then it's nothing. So there is this aspect about it. But also when it came to the act of making, I thought the weavers who I collaborate with were suddenly putting themselves in an interesting act of replication again, in which they were sort of doing the same thing three times, except the information was was becoming more blurry and less and weakening with every step. So it was a replication of an act, but not exactly. And then there was another example from receipts that I decided to also make into a tapestry work, where I made a purchase and three little machines ejected their own little, you know, proof of purchase. One was like the one that had to do directly with the credit card. The other one was like the in-store. But anyway, I got three. And when they gave them to me and stapled them, there was, again, this unity about them. It was the exact same thing expressed in three different documents. So what I did was I gave them to the weavers overlapping like this, and they made it into one piece. So these three kinds of threes, I had them exhibited in a show I did at the Blaffer Art Museum in Houston, that then traveled to the ICA in Boston, and I was hoping to establish a relationship between, you know, of three ways of saying three. I'm not sure I understand what you mean by the three in the complementary cornice and interval. So
rhythm that you have, it's like 1-2-3, 1-2-3, happens with the three arrested clouds.
Mm-hmm.
I could be making more of it.
No, I mean, rhythm, I think, is I'm glad that you bring it up. You know, rhythm is important in my work. And the number three, I think, sometimes is significant, but only because, you know, I didn't decide it. It's only because, you know, credit card vouchers came in threes. So I often like to work with standards. Like I like to work with, you know, letter sized standard, or, you know, like plywood sheet standard sizes. There's something about having not made a decision and then having that I know has there's a familiarity. Like all of us feel, you know, the same or similar kind of physical connectedness with certain standards that I think works when I'm making the artwork, because I know what it feels, and I know that you may feel the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess rhythm comes in there somehow.
Yeah.
Do you conceive the titles of your pieces in English, or do you do that in Spanish and then translate?
I do both.
Do you come up with the titles of your pieces in English or in Spanish and then translate?
I do both. That's a very good question, because titles are quite important for me. And sometimes they come in English, and sometimes I translate them. Sometimes they're translatable, and sometimes they're not. But this is something that I never take lightly. And I'm very irritated if sometimes one of my titles is translated and wrongly translated, because I think it destroys the work. So, you know, I work abroad a lot, and English inevitably is the lingua franca of the art world. Some people say bad English is the but then I say, you know, I didn't study all these years. I don't speak bad English. I speak good English. So often my titles are in English already. But it's important that, you know, certain words don't have the same resonance in they sometimes they don't translate well.
Yes.
Are most of your works related to social and economic situations or cultural situations, or maybe both?
I would answer with a question. Is anything social not economic? I don't think so. I think every social aspect, condition, has an economic implication. And saying it doesn't is looking at them like this.
You spoke earlier about being both a producer and consumer, and your artwork shows that you have feelings about both ends of that spectrum and thoughts. Have you ever been contacted or received commentary from any of the corporations whose products you use in your artwork, and did they get it?
Well, my work is not so massively seen. So chances of MasterCard coming to me and saying you used our logo or why did you do it have not really, not that I can think of. There was a case recently where I titled an exhibition after a quote from a text I read, and this a scholar in Oxford University wrote to the gallery and said, I would like to see that exhibition. That's titled after my... but that was just a little anecdotal, quite positive. But I have to say no. And also, my audience is much smaller than the mass audience of the big corporations. So somehow I feel that I speak to a smaller group, and in a sense, there is not a lot of conflict of interest. Ultimately, there is conflict of interest when people start making a lot of money or when things are really have an extreme, a real, real mass appeal. That's when corporations become interested, for good or bad.
But of course, artworks may outlive corporations, individual corporations.
We hope so, yes.
Yes. Yes.
Do you ever find yourself in collecting things? Do you see yourself, the things informing your ideas, or do you look for things after you've kind of solidified your ideas?
Things know more than I, so they are the ones that dictate. But I have to find them. I am never out there looking for that thing in particular, and then I see it. It would be like somehow find it. It would be like finding death somehow, like fate, and that would be the end rather than the beginning. I would rather just stay open, and when I see the thing and the thing tells me it has to be incorporated into a work or it says something, then I pick it up.
I thought it was interesting that you said it, you were irritated by the misinterpretation. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a piece that you were surprised at how well it was received because maybe you weren't 100% satisfied with it yourself? If you say no, I'll feel silly.
Well, I'm not sure I understand exactly what you mean by the question, but I almost understand it like, did I make a work that I didn't quite intend it and I was not happy about it, and then it had a good result?
And, yeah, or you might have just not felt right about it and it was just very well received and surprised you.
I'd say when I make something I'm not satisfied with, I very often exhibit it. And if I just find myself in that situation that I feel forced because of time or whatnot to bring it out and it's well received, I don't feel right about it. I would almost ignore that because, I guess I have a higher sense of self-critique than just trying to mask my own, being skeptical about the work with someone else's comment. You know what I mean?
Anybody else? Yes.
Yeah, I have one question. Since you say you create art with something probably with the original shape. Now, the two rocks in the three arrested cars, were they the way they were, or did you sculpt it?
No, I found them like that.
The question was about the two rocks and three mm-hmm. arrested clouds, and if you found them like that, or mm-hmm. if you sculpted them.
No, I didn't carve them. They were like that, and they were like that because a machine took them out of a quarry.
Yeah, quarry.
Out of a quarry, so they were somehow sculpted. And I think, if I may take the opportunity here, I think this is a good moment to express how sometimes I'm asked about almost two poles of the source material that I use in my work, consumer articles, and on the other hand, natural materials or unprocessed materials. And I really never see the categorical difference between the two. I think it's just a matter of degree. the difference between the rock that you see in the exhibition and this bottle, for me, is a matter of degree. They don't belong to a different category. One is not natural and this is artificial. I think, as I said, you know, I didn't sculpt that rock, and that rock, we could say, is natural. But, you know, for that rock to have reached this museum, there were many, you know, conditions that mediated it that are, in a sense, not too different to the fabrication of this bottle. You know, there was a corporation that built a, you know, machine, and then a company that extracted the rock, and then, you know, I had to be in a certain condition to, you know, to reach out for that rock. So it's a difference in degree, not in category.
Well, Gabriel Curry, thanks so much for talking with me and with us. Thank you.